conversation crossing many different intersections, including how we tie together resources and envisioning a future for Black people in particular. So I'm really curious. So Chief Innovations Officer, right? So this is an exciting area in that you get to kind of imagine the future in your work, right?
I do. I think the most exciting thing about this work, you know, is understanding that all of us have interconnections and relationships to what is possible for the future. If you have any relationships with elders, they're holding down, you know, the sacredness around what was, and the relationship with young people who are like, yeah, but this is what's hot now. And how do those two things marry? And so I think about the relationships in community, but I also think about the importance of the creative fields, the importance of what it means to use art as a through line to what is possible for the future. And those three things really flow into my work and into my world.
Gabrielle, before we go further, I want our listeners to really understand the work and the mission of the African American Leadership Forum, which is affectionately known in community as ELF. And I know it from back in the day when it was first formed because of my role in community and philanthropy, but I invite you to just really talk about the mission and the members and what constitutes ELF so that folks who are unfamiliar with it have a good sense as we go further with this conversation.
Sure. All right, so the African American Leadership Forum, formerly known as ALF, has been rebranded over the last year to be now known as the Forum. And we're really positioned in the city right now as a think and do tank. And that means that we use a combination of research across a variety of different intersections. So participatory, market, and just straight up old fashioned focus groups and conversations as a way to convene Black Minnesotans about the future of the future of our state. And we do that with the intention to really think about how are we shifting the narratives? How are we actually being drivers and advocates for folks in community? And so this isn't about, you know, us developing programs that are from our own initiative. We're actually using the input directly from community that drives what our pillar areas are, what our impact areas are, and how we think about using that as direction, as directors towards things like philanthropy and policy.
And we talked about the pillars. You want to unpack that a little bit?
Yeah. So we have a number of impact areas that are identified that are generational wealth building, economic prosperity, Black education, public safety, to name a few. And those were developed and guided by community. They were heard through a series of conversations over a number of years that are really saying, hey, these are the things we care about. These are the things we need resources behind. These are the things that we're really wanting to help direct and drive just the way that people are showing up for the community.
One of the things I love about that, and I can see as we think about kind of the innovative approaches to tying some of these things together, how that becomes a part of it. I'm remembering the stories of that my grandparents and my aunts would tell around ways in which folks would tie together all of these different things. We knew which doctor to see, what places to go, who in community can connect on certain things. And so when you think about, for example, just going out and getting a service or buying something, right? There are 15 people that you would talk to in community before going outside of community that kind of builds that spiral together. And so that excites me to look at some of the amazing and strategic ways that has happened, you know, in the past, and to see how that's coming full forward. So giving those pillars in those areas and direction, like what are some of the like cool like nuggets that you get to work on that are like pulling some of these things together?
Yeah. The dopest thing for me is that I was really positioned at ALF to help develop the framework around Black-centered design. And generally, people know it as human-centered design. If there is a practice that really engages and centers the individual's voice and centers the individual person's experience as guides and ways to help develop outcomes or known outcomes. The way that we have flipped it to benefit our community is to say, well, Black folks have a particular kind of culture, and inside of that culture, it exists. We all do. But specifically in the Black community, what does that look like in relationship to the way that we communicate? And that can be through volume, through levels, through hand waves, through all these things that are gestural that help also tell a particular part of the story. And so using cultural components that help develop the, I would say, the framework in which we show up in spaces with people help lead to us identifying what are the perspectives and creative evolutionary ways that we can solve systemic problems and centering our culture and our experiences at the center.
I think all that sounds amazing. Like everything you just said was like amazing, but to me, it's like overwhelming. Right, you're talking.
Not to me, because I get it.
It's an overwhelming. I feel like it's an overwhelming amount of work to the point of where do you start? Where do you start with something like this?
You know, the first place that we started is asking very, I would say, simple questions so that it's not overcomplicated. So, for example, if we're having conversations with Black folks about generational wealth building, we're saying things like, when you dream about having a home, like what and why do you want that space? And so the conversations that come out of that, you know, we don't know. We could predict and think about why someone would want a home. And what we've learned is that, like one sister said, I want a house because I want to control the backyard. And I know what's happening in that backyard. And I know that at the park, I can't control what's happening in those grass areas. And so for me, it's very particular about having natural spaces in which my kids can navigate, where I am not only thinking about their physical safety, but I can set up things that are very particular to them. I would have not been able to create that particular story or that particular known knowledge set without having prompted a question that was about dreaming. And I think a lot of people that are in philanthropy, and we know this from just being in community and the thousands of nonprofits that are in the city, it's always deficit-based. It's always about what you don't have, what you can't have access to, where you're not at, right. How can we fill this gap or need? But can the conversations be dream-based? And that is where Afrofuturism comes into play.
Love it.
I love that. I mean, I've talked plenty of times among our segments over the course of years how too often I think mainstream society views our communities, brown, black, and indigenous, as from a deficit base, you know, and we have so many assets to contribute, and we have so much visionary components to who we are organically. And we have to be. I mean, if you think about in order to withstand all the challenges that we have, and, you know, many folks call it resilience, resiliency and survival. I mean, folks can do a whole lot with very little. And that means, you know, you've got to be able to be resourceful in many ways, but also see what you do have still as a strength, you know, and as an asset. And not come from it from a defeatist standpoint. You know, I grew up inner city Chicago in the barrio where the measures of success were, as a girl, not getting pregnant while you're a teenager, not joining the gang, and not dropping out of high school. We never had health insurance. We had ice on the inside of our windows, you know, ice buildup. But when people would ask, were we poor? I would always say no. I mean, because we had so much. We had family. We had the ability to be close-knit, not only with our immediate family in the Latino community. It's beyond the nuclear family. And we did as much as we could with what we had. And it wasn't until, you know, you're older in age and you start looking at and reading about ACEs and, you know, where you fall on the questionnaire and all that stuff. I mean, I think about these things as you're speaking, because it really is one that we think of self-identity and self-empowerment from a place that really allows us to go further.
This is Counter Stories. You're listening to a special rerun from February 2024. I'm Halili, with co-hosts Anthony Galloway, Luz Maria Frias, and the late Donald Eubanks, and special guest Gabrielle Greer.
You know, I remember getting to participate in one of the focus group sessions, going through the this Black Center design process. The attention to the detail and how the room is set up and how the conversations are set up, you know, felt like home. We accelerated that kind of process of getting to know folks we didn't even know, because we were able to be basically speak our own language, right? Even though it's English, right? It's our language. It's not the standard. It's not King's. We got together, and one of the things that I really loved about that process is that we began in that value space with this idea that every single person around that table not just has something to contribute, but has a unique expertise, if you will, on not just Black experience, and we're asked to be experts in who we are. Everything was valued in the way that felt like it did, like it felt like community is supposed to feel in that regard. And so then what people would share out was amazing. And it seemed like it happened so much faster than it does outside of an outside space where other values are imposed to say, these are the things that we should value. Well, and I feel like the Black Center design process allowed for us to bring those aspects in the table and not insert a value system that's outside of our own in order to get things done. And I just felt like you were hugged in the process of adding your expertise. It was dope.
I think you hit the nail on the head there, which is not insert a value system that is outside of our own, but that we can show up in proximity to one another and, God forbid, like your nervous system be regulated and you not be on edge about, you know, judgment or critique or having to think about the way that you're going to speak or what questions people are going to ask. Are you going to get it? Are you going to understand it? And to be fully seen, and it is its own form of liberation. And I think that is what's incredibly important for us right now across all of our communities, is to consider what are the ways and the spaces in which we're constantly giving people back their own liberation and giving them the freedom to decide in calm spaces that are where they are welcomed. Like, man, you can share here and it's cool. Like, we're not going to take anything from you. Nothing is being pulled or extracted, because I am you and you are me and this is for us. So I think there's something powerful about that particular thing that you mentioned, Anthony.
This is Counter Stories. You're listening to a special rerun from February 2024. I'm Halili, with co-hosts Anthony Galloway, Luz Maria Frias, and the late Donald Eubanks, and special guest Gabrielle Greer.
I have mentioned, I think, a couple of times on Counter Stories that the only position that I've had where I felt that kind of freedom, where I wasn't judged, where I was among my people, is when I was Commissioner of Health and Human Services for the Mille Lacs Band, because I was working in my own community and I didn't have any of those other values until I reached out as a representative of Mille Lacs to interact with the state or the county or the feds. Then it was back into that world. But when I was working on the res, the very thing that you and Anthony have brought up, have explained, is the only time in my life where I've felt that freedom, where I felt where I wasn't being judged. Now, you know, within family, you know how you still have those dynamics. So don't get me wrong. I mean, not all this stuff fades away, right? You know, because family's family. And you know how that is in our Black side and our Native side. For me, family's family, you know, so those things are still there, but that freedom, the experience of not being judged of who you are, but being judged just by the character of who you are, which is totally different than what we experience in our day-to-day life here. And so that is a very free and empowering thing. And I, as you were talking about these focus groups, it reminded me that one thing I was able to do as I was getting my graduate degree from the University of Minnesota was to work with an individual, an elder in our community, in the American Indian community, where we did similar type things. And we would do focus groups with Native folks and issue these reports. It was with a place called the American Indian Research and Policy Institute. So there's a lot of parallels between what I'm hearing with the African-American Leadership Forum, Policy Forum, or Forum, now the Forum, and with what we were doing with the American Indian Policy Center back in the late 90s. So there's a kin there, because those focus groups in your community become powerful vehicles, because you're not coming in there with any idea of what's going to come out. You know, what comes out is what comes out. And then you take that and begin to build on that. And so that was also a very empowering experience to go through. And I can only imagine, you know, hopefully one of these days I'll get an invite from one of those focus groups too. So, but it's powerful work, you know, that's powerful work. I'm wondering if, because as you were talking about homes, I couldn't help but flash back to how things were when I was growing up. So there were economic reasons, there were different type of things. But when I think of my own experience, I grew up in the projects in North Minneapolis. And then in the 60s, as a result of activism from the Black community, you know, around housing and all these other kind of things that were negatively impacting our community, you know, we were kind of, it was in the 60s that my father was able to successfully buy his first home. Our first home was in the 60s. But I realized that economically there were differences, right? And I think those differences exist in our communities. You know, there's differences between all of us, Black, Native, whatever, but there are differences in our communities. And sitting in on those focus groups bring those type of things out, I think, that help us then build better community within our communities. So I was wondering if you could talk about that a little.
Yeah, that is what I feel. You know how when as you begin to mature and really have deep reflections on who you are and like, why did that happen? Like, why was I that particular kind of kid? Like this little weirdo kid, yeah. Like, what was that about? And I had a really amazing grandfather who built me this little wood stool. This is all relative. And as a kid, it was like my talking stool. And whenever I felt like tension that was going on in the family, I could stand on the stool and it was like my way of being like, hold up, I'm uncomfortable. Y'all have been doing this for too long. And that practice of learning how to use my voice and my elder giving me permission to have space to do that as such a young person holding these tensions continues to show up everywhere in my life and in my practice as this like, okay, you feel this way and you feel that way and nobody's wrong. So I think that's a big part of the forum right now and the commitment to my work, which is being able to hold the reality and the tensions that exist in our community, and that there's so many different policies and philanthropic organizations that unintentionally or intentionally divide us, that say, if you want a home and you may not be ready to own a home, then these resources are only for you. And so we only want to talk to the people that are interested in home ownership. We don't want to talk to the brothers. And so what happens when that sort of division is created, whether they're conscious of it or not, it's because at the center of it, it's not about holding everyone who's interested in that. And that shows are interested, is not holding all of the different perspectives that are connected to what it means to have a space and shelter where you feel safe and you like have a place to like convene with your family. This past fall, I held my first event at the Forum. It was called Dark Matter, and it is a creative exploration into Black education. And so we have these two leaders. And so holding these two people who were saying all kinds of things at the event. And so we're having these hard conversations, public conversations about people from our community speaking very directly from their values, from their experiences, and from their work, and not putting any judgment on it. And like my therapist says, let's just be curious. Let's be curious about why this is happening, Gabrielle. Let's not judge it. And so how can that continue, can continuously be not just this one-time situational experience, but become a practice through Black-centered design around us being able to hold the realities of what's going on in our community. We're not out here judging and shaming people for their thoughts and their different experiences, but we can create containers in which hold the tensions.
One of the things that I love about that exchange is that some folks will often in those spaces will get pulled into a conversation solely about the past. And you know, the true essence of Sankofa says we're going to engage in past, present, and future simultaneously. That's its core to much of the African ethos. But one of the things that I love about being able to do that and practice that is that it grows a muscle that is actually atrophying in much of what I see in the United States. And this is an example of one of the cultural elements of African identity, African heritage peoples, that is a huge asset to the world, especially at this time. But you're in the space, if we think about Afrofuturism, that's looking at technology, that's imagining that Black folks are in the future. So what are some of the imaginative things that are coming out of this work in your experience?
Yes. So I think one of the most fascinating experiences so far, we had a conversation with 200 plus Northsiders at Sanctuary Church, where we were having conversations around generational wealth, And I think so many people thought that the outcomes of those conversations were going to be solely about homes and solely about entrepreneurship. And of course, those were components because we know that, you know, those are big pillars in which people are able to generate wealth for their families and for the next generations. But what we could not have predicted, which is like the sweet, juicy part of Black-centered design, is that people were able to start imagining what a different kind of collaboration looked like. So conversations were like, okay, what if there was a farm and a cooperative and a daycare, like all on the same parcel? What does that look like? How do children benefit from understanding that the food goes from the urban farm into the cooperative? We hire people and young people that are learning that. And then, you know, we're all living on this space together. What if that happened in the city? What if that happened right in North Minneapolis on Broadway? And then there was this other part that was like, man, can we get back to what it feels like to be together? And can we put things together that if we didn't have all of this stuff and all these structures, all this stuff would be together anyway. There was all of this in one space. And can we get back to that? But can we do it in the context of what's happening right now?
Yeah, absolutely. And all of it imagines, and we can do it with an imagination that imagines that in the future, we are there. And that is something that a lot of what we consume doesn't imagine that we are. And so if we do that, we are working along that space. But also understanding that we've got to innovate as well. In the words of one of my favorite Afrofuturists, Octavia Butler, in order to rise from its own ashes, a phoenix first must burn. And so we've got to be able to ignite even within ourselves, if we want to be able to imagine what that looks like in the future. And so I appreciate you bringing that kind of lens to us today, Sister Gabrielle. I'm excited to, you got me lit up, and I'm about to go do some sci-fi imagining. And so, yes, absolutely. But it's not fiction, right? It's not fiction. We've been here, we will continue to be here, and we have assets within our community that can help save the world. This has been Counter Stories. I'm Anthony Galloway, pastor of St. Mark AME Church in Duluth, Minnesota, and partner at the Dendros Group.
I'm Luz Maria Frias, and happily enjoying life to its fullest in whatever comes my way.
And I'm Don Eubanks, member of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe Indians and associate of Dendros Group.
I'm Halili, owner of The Other Media Group, CounterStories producer and VP of programming at Ampers.
And our very special guest today.
And I'm Gabrielle Greer, thinker and doer of all things design and innovation. So happy to be here.
This has been CounterStories. What's on your mind? Let us know and find us online at counterstories.com and on Facebook and Instagram. CounterStories is a co-production of the CounterStories crew and Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. For our full conversation, please visit counterstories.com or wherever you get your podcasts.